Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Q Commentator. My goodness, two episodes, 1 week after another. Like a normal series, it'll never catch on. For those of you at least who are subscribing to each one. How are you? I hope you're well. Incidentally, mentioning subscribing, please do that. Hit that button. I'm sure that'll help the analytics or at least tell more people that we've got something going on here or something. Thank you to all of you who tuned in to episode 5, which featured John Murray. Do have a listen back to that if you haven't. Thanks to the Ox4. Who left a review on iTunes. Most enjoyable and informative. Thank you. Thank you to Richard Lowther, who tweeted at Q Commentator, loving the podcasts. I'm listening to them back to front. Keep them coming. So it's, yeah, probably going to be quite a few episodes till Richard realises I read out that message. A huge thanks to Deke Fleming, who messaged me, well, about playing football in his lounge growing up and that kind of image with a sponge ball. It wasn't going to break the 28-inch TV they had. He said it didn't matter who the commentator was. I would absorb all of them. Jock Brown, Barry Davis, the incomparable David Begg on Radio Scotland. They have all at some point or another been the soundtrack to my life. I've long been fascinated by sports commentary, and I can't begin to tell you how amazing your podcast series has been. You yourself are fascinating, and the guests have been everything you'd want them to be. Funny, informative, and utterly engaging. Thank you so much for the series. I'm now off to listen to the Ian Robertson episode for what must be the 100th time. It's like listening to the perfect comedy, drama, infomercial, lullaby. Absolutely wonderful. Deke, this is the reason I do it. I love these voices. I love finding out what makes them tick. And I'm so pleased that all of you who are tuning in are enjoying that too. Thank you so much for that message. It was so lovely to read. To this episode, then, number 6 of series 2, the longest lasting 6 episode series ever, given it started last September. But shush. Alison Mitchell has established herself as one of the great modern cricket commentators of our time. From tennis to pommel horse, Ali's covered a number of other sports, but it is her cricket that's her bread and butter. Alison has won the Sports Journalists Association Award for Sports Broadcaster of the Year, reporting not just on sport, but also on other more serious or poignant world moments too. In this episode, we will hear, well, how Alison has a fair bit of sporting acumen about herself, how there was a career that began in reporting before commentating really figured, learning from the great Richie Beno, I know, becoming the first woman to commentate on Test Match Special, the institution that is, broadcasting on some of the world's more serious or tense moments, not just in a sporting context, as I've referred to there. In contrast, then, keeping the fun and the laughs behind the mic. Really enjoyed speaking to Alison Mitchell. Please do leave a review on iTunes. Tell your mates about the series and enjoy our final episode of Series 2 before Series 3 starts next week. Shush, I just need a little sense of order. I should also say that there's a little sort of middle 10 minutes of this one where a little technical glitch meant we needed to use the Zoom sound of our chat rather than the recordings we had at each side. So it won't affect your listening experience too much, but I thought I'd be honest about it. So there's a little bit of that in the middle, but yeah, it should be absolutely fine. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Q commentator Alison Mitchell. Well, Alison Mitchell, thank you very, very much for joining me. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you, Nick. I'm sorry I haven't got a kind of hashtag live commentary t-shirt on. I should have been merched up to the max to come and chat to you. But no, it's good to see you as well, as we're chatting via camera as well. So yeah, very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. And ever the pro, you're recording at your end, I'm recording at mine. So people, you know, they can operate under the idea that we are sat in the same place. So much content these days is occurring under lockdown. People may listen to this at some point when we are in brighter times. But listen, thanks so much for joining me. A Northampton schoolgirl then, Wellingborough School, captaining the school tennis, netball and athletics squads, a bit of football and hockey too, a consideration in the early years of becoming a vet, English, German and geography A-levels, a bit of time at BBC Northampton as a broadcast assistant. We'll sort of maybe work that one in a second. But it's sort of...
Formative years, exactly.
And it says to me that there's a clear sporting passion. And then there are some very sensible A-levels to perhaps reassure mum and dad that there's a sensible career in the pipeline. But you were obviously a sporty girl.
Yeah, loved sports. It was just what I did. In fact, as I got older and then worked in sport, and I think it's the same for a lot of colleagues, you go into sport because you love it. And then once you work in it, you find you play it less and less and less because you're always out watching it and commentating on it, which is the next best thing. But yeah, I just played everything. That was where the sporting passion came really from playing it, rather than, like, I wasn't a sporting commentary aficionado when I was young, if you like. I mean, I, of course, you know, remember the 1988 Olympics and Barry Davis commentary. And because I played, well, hockey, I mean, I was pretty young then. But yeah, hockey was a massive part of my life, even bigger part when I went to university, because that was sort of the sport that I focused on. But yeah, at school, I just had a go at everything and fortunately seemed to be sort of quite good at it. But that was really, yeah, it was friends and it was being part of a team and that collectiveness and that trying together. I mean, we didn't always succeed. We as a hockey team, I remember we made a lot of finals and lost in the finals, mostly penalties. So that was always heartbreaking. But yeah, massively formative years playing all that sport for sure.
Yeah, and where would you say that sort of sporting acumen came from? I mean, obviously going to a good school kind of helps, but I know that, you know, obviously cricket is a major player in everything. I'm sure we'll talk about, and you were part of a sort of big cricket family. But was that coming from one side of the parentage and equal weighting? Where did that fit?
I don't know. As kids, I had an older brother. So my brother and I and our, you know, friend that we sort of grew up with, you know, lived across the road. We were just kids who loved the outdoors and we were just always out either on our bikes. And we grew up in a village from when I was 4 years old and we were always out on our bikes. We were fortunate that we had a garden that we could play sports in and kick balls around. We could, you know, construct our own sort of daily Thompson decathlon courses, you know, out of garden canes for hurdles and things like that in the garden.
Brilliant.
You know, we lobbed javelins.
Brilliant.
So we used our imaginations a lot to be active outdoors. And I guess then once I did go to my secondary school, where sport, you know, was a more of a formal part of life, then, yeah, I got a chance to... Well, that's the first time I got introduced to hockey, for example, and I could actually, yeah, take it forward. But, I mean, I think my dad was the, you know, the big club cricketer. And so that love, you know, got passed through to us. And my brother, massively into his cricket as well and played it. My mum, you know, just enjoyed social tennis and squash, you know, when she was sort of younger and growing up. So there's probably a bit of genetic maybe hand-eye coordination there. But I mean, we weren't, you know, I didn't have parents who were professional sports people or anything like that. We just... Yeah, sport was often on the telly. It was a part of life. It wasn't our be-all and end-all by any stretch. You know, I also enjoyed doing a bit of dance, and music was a massive part of my sort of school years as well. So it was always quite a kind of rounded... I liked having
What sorts of music? What eras do you fall into?
Oh, more playing it, actually, rather than listening.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I played the guitar. I started playing when I was about 8 years old. Basic chords. I actually used to play the guitar at the church that we went to. So I would, with a friend of mine who sang, I'd often, yeah, on a Sunday, so sort of like through my school years,
you are completing this middle class picture that we've got, Alison. It is just, it's all coming together.
Yeah, but you know, yeah, the guitar is one of the best things I ever did, actually. Yeah, I loved it. I learned classical, but then, yeah, would just pick up and learn to strum and play whatever I liked, but got hours and hours whiled away with friends just mucking around playing
Fantastic.
Music. But yeah, the sports that combined with broadcasting sort of happened when I was about 16 and got an opportunity to do my GCSE, as it was then. GCSE, glad to know that, you know, some things in life haven't changed. yeah. Did my GCSE work experience placement at BBC Radio Northampton, as you mentioned. That came about because I'd done a little bit of, I suppose at school, like in English classes, I quite enjoyed, you know, when we got a chance to do a bit of public speaking. If I had to make a speech or do readings, I didn't mind doing it. I quite enjoyed doing it.
You mentioned playing music. Were you in school plays and that kind of stuff?
Yes, I would not say that acting was my forte, however. But I did, yeah, by the time I was in my sixth form, drama was the one thing that I hadn't really cracked. So believe it or not, I got a part playing the headmistress in Miss Jean Brodie, Pride of Miss Jean Brodie, Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. And yeah, I was okay. I had to put on a Scottish accent throughout. I think I realised that I was never going to be an actress. But, you know, I had a crack. I had a go.
Yep. It is all about having a go. So, and then sort of to move through your sort of early life a little bit, playing hockey for Northamptonshire, you mentioned Midlands Development Squad, Nottingham University Hockey Club captain, I understand. Now, I'm guessing that, you know, not only is there a love of sport here, but I mean, hockey captain, that suggests you can handle a drink or two as well, right?
If I told you that I was actually designated tour leader in my third year.
Oh, my Lord.
Hockey was brilliant. Friends which I'm still in touch with now, because you've just shared some very, very sort of life-affirming, maybe, experiences.
That's an excellently polite way to put it. Good.
So, university. Sometimes I played hockey 6 days out of seven. I think Monday night you could play, we had training Monday night. Tuesday you could play hall hockey. Wednesday was the university's leagues, Booster as it was then, it's now Bucks. Thursday night, training again. Friday, often off, but was our kind of, you know, club bonding, which was in the local nightclub called The Zone. And early Saturday local league, usually about 9 a.m. pushback, which was a killer, Saturday morning. And then Sundays off. Maybe do a little bit of study, get that coursework in.
While you're racing through a hangover that you built up all week. So, you know, it sounds like an enjoyably full life with plenty of sport that you had going on. And you mentioned, obviously, then you had that chance at 16 to do a bit with BBC Northampton. Mm-hmm. And I know that you've sort of looked back, I think, in another interview that I read, you sort of thought, oh, well, actually, although it wasn't a dream I necessarily had, actually, I was getting mates round and doing radio shows or having fun things. And you mentioned public speaking. So there's an element of all of this coming together, isn't there? When did the path come together, and when did it all sort of start to point in one direction?
Yeah, you mentioned those radio shows. That was just, again, something that I used to do, you know, for fun with friends. We would, you know, get the old cassette deck and, you know, a couple of old microphones that, you know, were knocking around the house, and we'd just love to, we sort of did like mock Blue Peter programs, you know, here's one I made earlier, this sort of thing. And so I guess that was always there. Like, I didn't remotely at that age think that radio or broadcast or media was something that
I was exactly the same.
Yeah,
by the way.
Seriously,
there are still tapes that exist of me talking like that, doing a little radio show.
Oh, we've got a mock like 6 o'clock news. You know, we made little sort of, you know, banners for the wall and everything, logos. That's when my dad got a camcorder at some stage in the 90s,
yeah.
I think.
I'd be very the same, very similar.
So it was really the coming together started from when I was 16, did that work experience placement, and that gave me the radio bug. But when I was at Radio Northampton, the sport element came in for me, because really for me, the coolest show of the week and the only one that I really wanted to be involved in was the Saturday sports show. But doing the work that I did at the radio station across my sixth form meant that I'd go in like one night a week on a Monday, I'd finish school, I'd get across to Northampton, and I had a job that was 5:30 p.m. until 10 p.m. and it involved answering the phone lines, like wrapping up the prizes, posting them off for the competition winners, sorting out all the music for the next day's programmes. And it was just a brilliant grounding in terms of how a radio station worked. And one of those jobs was also, I don't know whether you remember the old reel-to-reel tape that used to be used for editing. Yeah. All these tapes, you would have to empty the reels into these big wheelie bins. So literally one of my jobs was just pulling off these reels of tape into the wheelie bins, then dumping them out in this skip out the back. But it gave you really good, exactly, gave me a really good grounding though, and an all-round picture of how radio station worked, because I did get to help out across a range of programmes. And in my school holidays, gave you more of a chance to sort of get involved in like the Northampton Balloon Show, for example, where Radio Northampton always had a stand, or you might get to go out with the radio car and help out the presenter. So yeah, really, really grateful for that opportunity. And the one piece of advice that I remember receiving during that time was really what did set me on my way. Because of course you start to ask people, well, look, if I want to do this seriously, what do I do now? What do I do next? And everyone's got a different pathway. And I mean, you would have found that chatting to all the other commentators. There's no right or wrong. And I get contacted by students a lot for advice. And there is no set path or prescriptive way of doing it. But my way of doing it was I followed the advice where someone just said, if you've got the opportunity, go away and, you know, get a good degree in a subject you enjoy, because university wasn't my horizon. And then you can do a postgrad diploma in broadcast journalism. And that specifically trains you to be a sports journalist.
Yep.
And so that's what I decided I would do. So lots of applications formed later, and lots of hockey tours and nights in the zone in Nottingham, and a geography degree at the end of it. And eventually a qualification as a broadcast journalist as well.
Yeah, well, there you go. And actually a sort of almost the right path compared to some of the other people. I mean, you know, that's getting the kind of keeping mum and dad happy, having the fallback plan, but then going for the perhaps the more vocational path or the thing you were most interested in. And so, I mean, somewhere within that journey was being the person that's chucking reels out in the bin and going out in the radio car. But then that moment where you were going to put yourself on air and you did want to do more stuff. So there was clearly a drive in there to actually want to use the voice and get on the air yourself. Where do you sort of remember wanting to make that step?
Yeah, there were a few moments, I suppose. There are a few disasters as well. I do remember one time I got an opportunity to help out on the Radio Northampton breakfast show. I had been, you know, I'd been in and shadowed. Unfortunately, I clearly didn't make correct enough notes, because one of the jobs was to record the morning circuit, as I would say, which was basically take the feed from London of all the actuality for that morning's news bulletin. And you had to stack up each tape, label each one clearly, you know, inwards, outwards, duration, you know, little sticky labels, and then line them all up with the requisite script ready for the newsreader when they came in. Unfortunately, when the 6 o'clock news began, I was down in the studio and the news booth was upstairs. So the voice kind of pipes in over the airwaves and da, 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 the 6 o'clock news. Overnight, there was a fire and da, 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 da. Let's get the latest so-and-so reports. I'm sorry, we can't bring you that report now. Let's move on to the next story. The next story, da, 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 da. Let's bring you the latest so-and-so reports. I'm sorry, we don't seem to be able to bring you that story.
Oh, my Lord.
Literally, instead of recording each actuality and each report, I had erased each tape. I thought my broadcasting career had started and ended literally there and then. But yeah, so you know, Radio Northampton gave me a little bit, the odd chance to be on air, mostly actually doing a pub quiz that was done in the regional programme. I'd come on and like, you know, read the answers and be a bit of a sidekick occasionally. But then more seriously, there was a bit of a moment when I'd spent a summer between my geography course and then going off to actually train as a journalist. I'd packed a summer full of work experience, which was, you know, really fortunate. I got in where I could. My contacts at Radio Northampton put me in touch with people at Radio Nottingham. So all the little bits you've done along the way sort of stack up. And I had spent a season as a runner with Channel 4 Cricket. That came about because I'd done a dissertation based on television and cricket and shadowed with Channel 4. They'd invited me back and given me some work. When I then went and did my geography, and when I then went to do my postgrad course, the exec producer rang me up towards the end of it to basically invite me back to work for them again the following season as a production assistant, which is sort of the very next step up from, you know, what I was as the runner. So it was definitely a step up. It was a step up in the behind the scenes pathway, I suppose.
And ultimately someone that was going to make you tea.
Someone might have made me a cup of tea by that stage. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I remember clearly sort of having a bit of a, it felt like a bit of a sliding doors moment. I felt as if I said yes to that, I was very much, I was in the industry. I was being given a paid role, but I knew by then that I wanted to broadcast. And I knew by then that I also loved the idea of commentating. I wanted to be behind mic watching the action, because part of that experience of being a runner taught me that you can spend your life working in sports for television and you might never see the inside of a sporting arena. You can be in a truck in the car park in the dark for 5 days of a test match. And for me, it
some of the world's best people do a very good job, obviously.
Absolutely. But... No, they're way more skilled than I ever would be at anything they do. But
they're not inside, are they?
No, it ignited the passion that actually for me it was the sport, and it was about describing and living the sport more so than I suppose the sort of technicality of creating a beautiful program, which is the skill of the directors and the producers. And
yeah.
So that cemented it for me. And so I found myself turning down an opportunity to actually go and rejoin the Channel 4 cricket team because I just felt I needed to pursue being on air. So who knows, you know, what direction I might have taken if I had, you know, accepted the offer and gone back to Channel 4. Things might have gone differently. As it turned out, I think it was the right choice for me to make because I, left college, started applying for work at actual proper, at sort of full-time jobs with the BBC whenever they came up. And eventually I did get a job at the BBC Asian Network on their sports desk. So I guess I was sort of up and running at that point.
Yeah, so I mean, the Asian Network gig that came in 2002. I mean, it's interesting because I think it's not come up so much in the previous chats that I've had, and I think Sarah Orchard is probably someone that would tap into it a little more. But is the sort of background actually that you had once you started to get on air with your experience doing reporting and being in ground and covering all sorts of things, and actually, you know, spending as many years and in as many roles as you did as a reporter before perhaps the commentating became as regular as certainly it is now. But I mean, you mentioned there, which I sort of, I almost feel like in the story, there's a little gap missing in what we've heard from you in this conversation, is that you said, you mentioned, well, I thought I want to get on air, but I want to be commentating. So that obviously fell in at some point. Can you remember sort of how that became a consideration and what your thoughts were on achieving it? Obviously with the elephant in the room being not many girls do that or did that.
Well, I think for me, that never actually was much of a consideration for me. I think I had grown up around boys, with boys, always playing sport with, you know, my older brothers, with my cousins, and sort of being around a sort of male environment I was never really conscious of sort of, you know, the fact that there weren't really, you know, any women doing it particularly. The idea of commentating definitely, I think, was set in. That seed was sown with the time that I spent with the Channel 4 team. Because, as I said, I was very conscious that summer of getting a view on all angles of sport. And even by then, I wasn't completely sure whether, did I want to do TV or radio? I think radio always felt like that was the place you started and then you maybe progressed into TV. But
and who was doing the lead commentary on Channel 4 at that time?
Well, Richie Beno was the number one.
Blimey.
I mean, that was, you can imagine when someone says, would you like to be a runner for us on Channel 4 cricket? And you realise you're going to be making Richie Beno a cappuccino, as was his drink of choice every day.
Good
but
start.
Yeah, no, the team, it was Richie Beno, Mark Nicholas, Dermot Reeve. Mike Catherton was working for them. Simon Hughes was the analyst. And actually, Sybil Ruscoe was the presenter reporter of the Saturday Roadshow that they did then. So, it wasn't a sort of all male on air team. I mean, sure, when it came to the actual commentating, it was. But I just always sort of mixed it with boys and men, and always kind of could hold my own.
It sounds like you're Yeah, it sounds like you're suggesting I always felt like I was one of the boys, so why wouldn't they give a job to one of the boys? I mean, it's sort of, in a way,
but the idea of sort of being one of the boys I don't like particularly either, because you need to be yourself, and I'm obviously
of course.
But yeah, no, I get what you're saying. I just fitted in. It never felt as if here were males and females, because actually behind the scenes on the Channel 4 team, there were a number of women as well. So actually, great, as a whole, the team was really mixed, and the women, you know, had a variety of senior positions, and everyone was completely equally respected. So yes, yeah, the on-air was very much the men commentating, but actually the Channel 4 crew was just brilliantly mixed, in a great bunch of people, male, female, whatever, just great bunch of people.
And I guess it's little surprise that if you're working around the great Richie Beno, that a bit of ambition to become a commentator is going to be perhaps where it takes you, right? If you're in the shadow of greatness like that, then that's a fairly lovely aspiration to have, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I felt very fortunate, and I had a really heightened awareness of the fact I had an amazing opportunity that very few other people would ever have been afforded, which was to just sit and watch and listen at close quarters to the greatest cricket commentator television has had, I believe. And I did. I made sure that if I wasn't, you know, racing around the ground with my headset on, taking meals to cameramen and bottles of water to the crew in the trucks, that, yeah, if I could grab 5 minutes, I would just lend an ear and listen. And even that's what I say to students now, is that the easiest way to learn is to switch on your TV and switch on your radio and listen with a critical ear. You know, make notes if you need to, but actually listen with a critical ear. Don't just let it wash over you like you sort of do, you know, when you're being entertained by commentary. You're listening, but you're not necessarily paying acute attention. So
you'll no doubt have advice, you know, and learnings overall. But can you remember what you felt you learned, what you observed from someone like Richie himself?
Well, from a TV commentary perspective, he was always about less being more. And he had some sort of very particular kind of commentary lessons, if you like, in that, you know, it's always about saying, you know, never saying we or I, you know, it's always the team. You are the third person describing what is going on. He was big on perspective as well, in that, you know, a dropped catch is not a tragedy. He'd say, you know, famine in Ethiopia is a tragedy. This is, you know, yeah, dropped catches.
This is not a battle and a war, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And it's about adding to the picture. So there was, yeah, he had some very particular sort of lessons. But it was more, I think, again, that experience really just to see how a cricket commentary box operated. Was amazing, grounding and inspiring, kind of to instill in me that fact that, yeah, no, I want to do that one day, and I had this sort of insane belief that I could, and that I would somehow. I don't really
Fantastic.
Know why, because it sounds like I must have been arrogant to have thought that at age 21 to think, you know, I have confidence that I know enough about the game that one day I'll be able to do this.
I think self belief is allowed. You know,
maybe.
I think you know, your Northamptonshire background and what you've, you know, what we know of your upbringing allows you to be as British and reserved as the rest of us all, and go, oh, I can't be self effusive. How someone will take me down? Surely, I'm sure if you were born with, you know, American blood from the East Coast or the West Coast, you would be perfectly entitled to feel as confident in your talents and abilities, and to tell other people about them. But you know, it's brilliant. And ultimately has probably been the fire in you that's given you the confidence to go on, I'm sure. I mean, just to touch on the reporting side of things again, and we'll come back to the commentary in earnest in a moment. But, you know, you were in over a number of years in reporting, and you know, I'm sure you still will as well. But you've certainly had some challenging moments in covering various stories and tournaments, and you know, the death of Bob Woolmer comes to mind. You were reporting after the terror attacks in Mumbai, the death of Australian cricketer Philip Hughes, and broadcasting from his funeral. And I remember hearing you on air at that point. You know, some very emotionally trying times, which not only requires a certain amount of skill in broadcasting, but you know, is something that then allows you to be able to bring probably the right tone and pathos to commentary and live events going forwards in that other discipline. I mean, how do you feel being a reporter, not only in terms of experience on air, but has informed your voice as a commentator?
First of all, I think being a reporter absolutely laid the foundations for me being able to commentate. So on two fronts, really. First of all, absolutely the art, the mechanics of reporting, the disciplines of, as I learned on radio, the disciplines of radio reporting, economy of words, speaking to time, giving the right facts, adding a bit of description, all of that you learn on the job through doing reporting. I don't think anyone, you know, it's not necessarily fair to sort of drop someone in and expect them to be able to commentate. You know, it all you learn over a period of time. But importantly, also the process of being a reporter and getting, as one of my managers at the BBC used to say, getting air miles, sort of into your legs, if you like, is that you gain the audience's trust. And that's such a key part of being a broadcaster, sort of being authentic, being true, but knowing that earning the audience's trust, because if people don't believe what you say and believe in it and trust you that you're delivering something with gravitas, then it's very, very hard to commentate with authority. And it was necessary, absolutely, to do the years of reporting and the miles up and down the motorways and the hours at county cricket grounds that I did to build up that stack of experience so that, across, you know, a wide range of things. It means that when you are actually behind the mic in a completely live situation, that you can respond and you have got experiences to fall back on and you have that understanding of balance as well and light and shade. And not leaping to conclusions, you know, if you're in a situation, and as I found myself in Pakistan in 2005, which was just after the London terror attacks, and it was the first first England men's tour that I'd been on, but it was also the first to involve really heavy duty security. So, you know, we were in armed convoys on the way to the ground. So that was the backdrop, you know, against which that tour was on. And I remember being at the test match in Faisalabad and there was suddenly a massive explosion and there was debris suddenly spilt across the outfield and the crowd was sort of in a bit of a frenzy suddenly and the players kind of started running from the field to the pavilion and you didn't know what happened. Everyone's instinct was thinking, oh my God, it's a bomb. Oh my God, a bomb's gone off. You couldn't say that on air because you didn't know. You know, that sort of thing. Again, I think that intuition sort of comes from experience of understanding and knowing not to overreact, not to leap to conclusions, to have that sense of perspective, right, let's just hold on a minute, what has happened? Describe what you can see. Don't stray from the facts. What can we see? What do we know? What don't we know? And be very clear and calm on the airwaves. And I was reporting that test match for the Asian network. And
incredible.
I don't think I'd have been able to have handled that even well enough then if I didn't have, you know, a few years of reporting experience before me even at that point. But certainly when it came to doing ball by ball commentary, albeit that when I was younger, I was saying that, you know, I never felt out of place in a male environment. When it actually came to start doing my first ball by ball, I was very acutely aware of the media environment that I was in at that time and the fact
that... Where was
it? Well, there was first county commentaries and first England commentaries. And the first county commentary was at Chelmsford, I'm pretty sure. I think it was a Northants Essex game, the Pro 40. And so it was a very low-key game. You know, no pronouncements were made about the fact that I was going to be, you know, leading commentary. And that was the same when it came to me doing my first England commentary in 2007, and that was the World T20 in South Africa. And my summarisers were Ian Chappell and Jeff Boycott. Some might have said that was a baptism of fire, but I'd had the opportunity to get to know both beforehand. And again, that's another part of commentary, is being comfortable with your summarizers and them being comfortable with you. And I'd had that opportunity.
Absolutely.
And again, because of the work and the experience I already had, they were familiar with my work. So they knew that I knew what I was talking about. But yeah, I was very aware then that I was doing commentary at a time, if you remember, 2007 was just when Jackie Oatley, who's a very good friend of mine, had done her first Match of the Day commentaries, and there'd been an almighty storm, and Jackie had to put up with all sorts. So I was doing my first commentaries, sort of having lived through that experience with her as a best friend, to then doing my own first commentaries. And TMS had Donna Simmons commentate for them a few matches in 1999-2000. She was a Bayesian lawyer by profession. Peter Baxter had sort of discovered her. She did do sports broadcasting out in the Caribbean and had invited her to do a few games. But there had been nobody before her and nobody since. It had been a decade and people just didn't really, the whole scene was male broadcasters. So I was very, very acutely aware then and put an enormous amount of pressure on myself to not stuff it up, basically, because I didn't want to stuff it up for maybe another decade to come where there wouldn't have been an opportunity for another woman, because it wouldn't have been, Nick, that thing of, Alison Mitchell's a terrible commentator. She got things wrong. Like, we don't like her. It would have been female commentators are terrible.
It would. I'd love to tell you it wouldn't have been, but of course it would.
And I was so well aware of that. So I felt like I couldn't put a foot wrong at all, And it was, you don't want to put a foot wrong as a commentator at all. Of course you don't. But, in a live broadcast, even now you listen and people will sort of correct themselves if they, call mid on instead of mid off, or they, mistake a fielder and they correct themselves. But it felt as if at that time in that climate, that if I had mistaken the name of a fielder, that someone was waiting to leap on it and would have used it as a stick to beat the future of all female commentators with. So, it was a big pressure then.
You're ending up doing some of your early commentary with, like you say, that sense of not getting something wrong rather than feeling free and relaxed enough to do something great.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I think I put a lot... Well, I did. I know I put a lot of pressure on myself to be absolutely correct. But also, it probably made me, I'd hope, a better commentator in the long run, because I did want to go the extra mile, because I felt like I did sort of have something to prove. And I was always conscious of, right, what is it that I'm going to offer, that I can offer, that is different to the people I'm sitting alongside? They are the former players. I mean, that'd be the same feeling for any commentator, journalist commentator, someone who hasn't played the game at a high level, but it was sort of doubly so because of my gender and everything we've just talked about. So it was right, what can I offer that demonstrates that I know the game and can give a little bit more? And for me, it's always just research, storytelling, bringing the journalese to the commentary, and leaning on, using your summarisers are there to talk about the intricacies of the forward defensive stroke. That's not my job. So my job is, and my forte is research, it's description. Yes, it's knowledge and nous about the game, but knowing there are sort of quite well-defined roles and then playing to that strength.
Tired of ads interfering with your favourite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last.
Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Well, let's talk about approaching a commentary then. You want to get it right. You do the research. I know that side of it very, very well. What do you do to get yourself there in the frame of mind? Do you do anything to get the voice there to warm up? Are you conscious as a female broadcaster about the tone? And because we all know how John, who comments on the Daily Mail website, is going to make some remark about, oh, she's all screamy. So tell me a little bit about how you approach the technicality of it.
Well, I like to start with an aria and then I do 20 press-ups. No. not much in the way of voice prep. Although saying that, when I was doing early shift, this is not for commentary even, but early shift, I'd be in the car sort of, maybe it's just because it's so early in the day, and I'd do some oms. You ever done oms, Nick? Oms.
Yes.
Om. And maybe practice some vowels. This really gets your mouth moving. A, E, I, O, U. So I haven't, sometimes I'll do that for commentary as well if I'm in a quiet moment and, feel it's something that I want to do. But otherwise, it's in the preparation of the research. So for me, it's the same if I've done Olympic sports with gymnastics or golf or tennis. But for cricket, there's a bit of a routine. And I was listening to John Murray actually talk about how he prepares for football matches the other day, and I think I'm definitely of the John Murray school of commentary prep. He's also fastidious in terms of attention to detail, but I feel as if I need to have no stone unturned. It's my job when I'm behind the mic to know more than the person next to me and more than the listener. So
and know more on your sheet than probably the 15-20% of it that you're actually going to use in the commentary, but if it's totally there, you can relax and do your job. I mean, I meant to ask as well, when you mentioned doing your sort of first county cricket game, the Northamptonshire game or whatever, I mean, you heard yourself do commentary at that point. So what did you think of what you heard? What do you think of your voice and your style, which people love me asking them?
I had heard myself commentate before, because that again was all part of the learning and the practice. And again, I think the reason why there wasn't much, going back to that first England commentary, which was the first high profile commentary that I did really, there wasn't any backlash, and I've never really had, much in the way of sort of criticism. Certainly the odd one, and I could quote you some, but on the whole, there wasn't. And I think that was because of the air miles that I had done previously. Mm. And again, the fact that I had been afforded the opportunity of going to some county games when I was there reporting, I'd use the time that I wasn't doing my, 1 minute update every hour to commentate into a tape and listen back and cringe, and then commentate again, and then listen back and cringe some more. But you get better by doing it. So,
well, yes. And that taps into, you mentioned people who get in touch with you for tips and people who get in touch with me. So, what do you think I should do? I want to get into journalism. Do you want to write or do you want to broadcast? Mm. Oh, maybe broadcast. Then have you started doing it? No. Well, start doing it. I mean, the apps, the opportunities, you can have a phone with you, whatever it is, just start doing it. Listen to yourself back and critique.
And you know what, Nick, in what you've been doing at Life Commentary, that is honestly almost like the first thing I commentated on was in my postgrad course, being asked to just to go out into the street and talk for a minute. And it was basically like, who can keep the talk going for a minute? And that's whether you're news or sports, at some stage, even in news, people were asked to commentate on a royal wedding or whatever it might be. Or you've got to just hold the airwaves. So it's amazing how you can fill a minute by, describing some leaves on a tree gently wafting, or, a pigeon which is swooping down to peck a little seed off the ground,
Yeah, well, indeed. But also, actually, I mean, while I know that you've commentated on the Olympics and Commonwealths and tennis and golf and various things, which is, the lovely opportunity that working for a broadcaster like the BBC can give you, you also, in terms of stepping into cricket, are in the kind of world where, although there can be and will be explosive moments, there's a very different pace to an awful lot of it. And you know, the fact that you have been, you know, the first woman to have become a regular commentator on TMS is absolutely brilliant. And you know, calling ball by ball on what is it, ABC Radio Grandstand in Australia, these kind of moments and institutions where people are getting not only a female voice for the first time, but where you're having to find the right rhythm, which is probably more so in that radio sense of obviously painting pictures and whether it's pigeons flying down on the edge of the boundary or whatever. But there's a very definite skill to that conversational style that's quite different from, you know, commentating on a luge time trial or whatever it might be in an Olympics.
Yeah, you're right. It's not one concentrated burst, is it? Cricket's really conversational. And from chats with Aggers, you know, before I, you know, took to the microphone, I'd have an opportunity to, you know, talk to him about the rhythms of test commentary, which are different even to the rhythms of a T20, because the pace of the game is just different. So the test match commentary, he always likened it to, and I tried to take that on board, the sense of two friends sitting at a ground, watching the game and passing conversation between them. But it is still an art form, I feel, you know, to kind of crack, to really be natural and at ease, to have a conversation and then go back to the action, have a conversation. There's still times, Nick, where I will describe a ball and then I've completely forgotten where what we were talking about. so even now, after all these years, and it's been a lot of years, even now still, I'll get a mind blank. You know, we'll be talking about something, bowler comes, runs in, bowls, and maybe it's a glorious four through the offside and something, at you know, some event happens. Yeah. And then you go, oh, where were we?
Yeah. I'm terribly sorry. I'm being such bad company. I'm commentating on this cricket game while I'm having a chat with you.
But I mean, that's what Aggers has absolutely down to a T, is that such a relaxed style of conversation and at ease, but yet using your voice as an instrument, isn't it, in commentary, so that if anybody turns on the radio at any one moment, well, A, they want to know what the score is, so that's the most important thing, but using your voice as an instrument, they should be able to tell within the first few seconds of listening what sort of phase the game is in. You know, is there a slight urgency to your voice? Is it a run chase nearing conclusion, or is it a meandering phase? You know, we're heading towards lunch.
Really
scoring
important.
Rate's only about two and over. Yeah, and that I think I love about it as well. Maybe that's something to do with the, you know, my sort of love of music as well, that sense of using your voice, yeah, as an instrument and an indicator.
Yeah, I think that's hugely valid, and regular listeners to Q Commentator will have certainly had plenty of musicality and music playing a part in the whole thing. What moments have you particularly enjoyed in the commentaries that you've done? And I'm not talking necessarily, you know, great lines, but have there been moments that you sort of put the mic down and gone, that was a treat, that was, or even I nailed that, you know, I mean, that's kind of what I'm asking, really.
Yeah, there's loads, actually. Some of them, I think upset moments are always amazing. Mm-hmm. I can remember being in centre court commentary box for Five Live commentating on Wimbledon when Nick Kyrgios first came on the scene and knocked out Rafael Nadal. So that was an amazing moment, Nadal going out, and I was on air for the climactic set and the match point for that one. Gymnastics has given me so many amazing moments at the Olympics, and the Olympics was a real dream. That really was. I suppose that wasn't sort of initially on my radar, because I had gone into broadcasting kind of through a real particular cricket focused route, and my eyes got open to multi-sport events when I got asked to go to the Commonwealth Games in 2006 in Melbourne to do updates. And that was actually what I was doing in Beijing at the 2008 Olympics as well, until I got a phone call saying Great Britain's got someone in the final of the pommel horse, we don't have a gymnastics reporter because we weren't expecting, you know, this to happen. Could you go to the gymnastics arena? And so
brilliant.
I remember John Imberdale throwing to me on air saying, well, we're going to have Five Live moment of history now. We're going to have Five Live's first ever pommel horse commentary.
And no pressure.
My knowledge of the pommel horse at that stage had amounted to a 3-minute conversation with the late Mitch Fenner, who is the BBC's television gymnastics commentator, who actually happened to be a TMS fan as well. So he was, I think he was quite pleased to have a chat with me, and I was even more pleased to have a chat with him, because I just said, Mitch, give me the
basics of a pommel horse commentary. Just give me a little bit of lingo so I can sound as if I know what I'm talking about, and just give me some key things to look out for. And I just said to myself, I've just got to keep this as simple as possible. And I managed to describe, again, saying what you see is what commentary is. So if you can walk outside your front door and talk for a minute about whatever is going on in life, you can commentate on pretty much anything, as long as you've got a little, you know, enough detail of the crucial things you need to know. So yeah, I was able to commentate on Lewis Smith winning a historic bronze medal, wasn't it, in the 2008 Olympics. But then Max Whitlock has been an absolute superstar. So I really enjoyed the duels between Max and Lewis, in particular the pommel horse, and Max's double gold at Rio was stupendous, and the team bronze that the GB men got at London 2012 was an absolute highlight without question, because there was an upset, there was a pommel horse inquiry, and then tipped them to silver.
You're fully experienced on that by then.
I had sort of become a mini gymnastics expert, because I had then had the privilege of going to every world and European championships in between Olympic cycles, so it became my Olympic sport. And Beth Tweddle, an absolute superstar, you know, it's been wonderful, real privilege to have followed, you know, the latter part of her career as well doing that. So yeah, so I've spoken about all sorts of highs and none in cricket so far, have I?
That's all right. I mean, it's lovely. That's the rich tapestry of the work you've done, which is great.
I'll give you a cricket moment though, because I mean, obviously there was moments like England women winning the 2017 World Cup, where I was on the microphone for the big moment. But you're not often on the microphone for the big moments, because you often, in a test match, you sort of know when the win is coming often.
Yeah.
And there's a long-standing tradition in Test Match Special that, well, A, it's often it will be Aggers who will take, you know, the big winning moment if it's England. And as happened in the 2005 Ashes, if you remember the tight finish at Edgbaston, felt as the runs ticked down that Australia were going to win that one. So the mic was given to Jim Maxwell as the visiting Australian commentator,
right,
to call what was probably going to be the Australian winning moment. As it was, he ended up commentating on England, you know, yeah, and won by 2 runs, and an iconic piece of commentary from Jim. But yeah, as a sort of, yeah, more junior member of the team, it was, yeah, often unlikely that I was ever going to be on for one of those massive TMS kind of winning moments.
Yeah,
but I had quite a few where I was on air live with Five Live doing that. So World Cup 2011, an incredible tied game, Bangalore, and Sachin Tendulkar sort of dominating, and Andrew Strauss dominating with 100 of his own. An amazing Tendulkar moment, actually, at the 2008 India tour. So this was after the tour had resumed after the Mumbai terror attack. So the country was in a state of turmoil. There were, you know, umpteen security at the ground in Chennai. And Tendulkar at that stage, there was a bit of a monkey on his back about the fact that he had never really scored a big second innings to win a match for India. He never scored a second innings 100 to take them to a victory. And Sehwag, England set them what was at the time was going to be a record run chase. Sehwag went berserk the night before to sort of set things up. But Tendulkar took over and he was on like 90, I can't remember. Let's say he was on, I think, 96 or not, or 98. He hit a 4 to both bring up his 100 and win this test match for India in the wake of the Mumbai terror attacks. He dedicated that victory to all of Mumbai and to India. He was a Mumbaiker himself. And just a real groundswell of emotion in that one flourishing stroke for 4. The 100, the win, the monkey off his back, doing it for India, healing Mumbai. It was just a really moving moment in cricket. And one, that's certainly one which has stayed with me. And it wasn't even an England victory.
Yeah,
no, I'm not surprised. Amazing. What would you say are your favourite bits of the job? Your favourite bits of commentating, let's say, first of all?
Ooh, it's a toughie. I think it is when you, yeah, when you're living a moment, when you're so wrapped up in it with the person next to you, with the crowd, with the action. It's actually akin to a sort of a mindfulness almost. I honestly think it is. It's like you go into a zone, you know, sportsmen and women have a zone where they're in. And when you're really so involved in it, I think that's probably when you do your best commentary as well, because you're just riding everything sort of perfectly and it's in sync and you don't even notice the passage of time. So when someone taps you on the shoulder and says, "Oi, get out the seats, your time is up," and you feel like you've only just sat down, that kind of means you've had a really fun 20 minutes behind the mic. The laughs are a brilliant aspect of it on air, when you feel like you sat down, just spent a really enjoyable 20 minutes with someone watching something that you both love. So it's fueling a passion, really. Yeah, we are really, really lucky to do something that we love so much.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I touched on it earlier, but the nature of something like TMS and cricket broadcasting and the more ebb and flow and conversational style of it there is, I guess, you know, part of it, we know that sport is about entertainment sort of at the end of the day, but, you know, there's a lot of money in it, high stakes, very, very committed athletes and that kind of thing. But actually, the role that you must play in that time to ensure there's some entertainment alongside perhaps the high stakes sporting stuff, or, you know, low stakes sporting drama, which there can be at times, is a responsibility as well.
Yeah. And what's also really gratifying is when you realize actually what we do touches people as well, because sometimes, you know, you can have a sort of mediocre day, you might not feel completely up for it, like everyone does in any job that they do. Like, we can't always be perfect and be on it all of the time. I mean, yeah, it's our job to get up for it for sure, but, you know, every now and again, like, you'll get an email from either someone who's visually impaired and is blind and tells you that you have painted the pictures of cricket for them. That is kind of, you know, it's so gratifying. You know, you turn around in the commentary box, you don't know who might be standing behind you, and you realise that they're a massive fan of the programme, and they, you know, appreciate sort of, you know, what you do. Because, you know, in the grand scheme of things, what we do is not important. You know, we're not saving lives, we're not looking after people in hospitals like the NHS are at the moment. But then, and I think also some of the response to commentaries that have been replayed out, you know, during these corona times when there is no live sport, people are remembering how much sport does mean to them and actually how it can transport you to a happier place. So there is a role for it, and you can feel a little bit useful in sometimes quite a, you know, an otherwise helpless situation as we're in at the moment. But yeah, certainly, I think when you're able to step back and when other people tell you what it means to them, that's a really gratifying thing, because yeah, what we do is not important in the grand scheme of life, but it can be really important and can touch people's lives in a way that you just don't realise. I think radio sometimes in particular, because of the very sort of close nature of it, the very personable and private sometimes nature of it, you know, people letting you into their homes, into their cars, under their duvets sometimes in the middle of the night when we're watching the Ashes.
Into the bath with them or whatever it might be.
Yeah. So, yeah, some of that listener feedback is really, really touching.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I was sort of, you know, I asked for the commentary bit to begin with, and the next bit was going to be the romance bit, perhaps, you know, the obviously there's the travelling the world and getting to watch the sport, but I think you probably covered it off in terms of actually that feeling of being privileged enough to bring those feelings to people or play that role in being company and those sorts of things. I mean, it's come up in the sillier side of commentary and the videos that I've been doing in people getting in touch and saying, thank you for making me laugh and giving me something, you know, that's taken me out of my head for a few minutes. So there is a value to that. What do you think with the experience that you've had over the years, what do you think makes a good commentary? And I ask that from, you know, from cricket to gymnastics to Wimbledon. What do you think makes a good one?
Oh, there's sort of all sorts of elements that blend together, aren't there? And so much of it relies on the action as well. You know, when people say what's a memorable bit of commentary, it's usually attached to a memorable piece of sporting drama. So without the sport, you know, you need the sports men and women to do their bit and give you something amazing to commentate on. And then it's your job to augment the moments, because we are augmenting it. You know, the moment is not us. It is about giving the moment to the viewers and the listeners. So yeah, I suppose overall though, if you take a package, commentary in its very basic form is telling people what's happening who are not there to see it themselves. So you've got to be informative. You want to be entertaining, because it is an entertaining industry, and that can be in the cadence of your voice. It can be with the interactions with your summariser. It can be with the choice of words you use, the language, the anecdote that you tell, the observation that you make. And it's, of course, informative because you're telling people what is happening. And again, radio and TV, there's differences, aren't there? Radio is so much more about painting the picture because the audience isn't there to see it themselves. Unless, of course, they've got a little earpiece, in the ground and they're watching and listening at the same time. But I think all those things wrap in together. The rapport that you have with your summariser next to you goes into the mix as well. But being able to convey a moment of drama, I reckon if you've got an amazing moment of drama, if you're able to give someone goosebumps, I think you've done a pretty good job in terms of a moment of commentary. But then commentary is so much more than that one moment. There's that clippable moment that goes into the archives. But actually, yeah, the great commentators are those who you could switch on at any time and sort of appreciate the fullness of what they're doing.
I think when I get to the point of turning Q Commentator the series into a book, I'm probably going to have to have a chapter that says how to give someone goosebumps, and I may have to get on the phone and get a more direct lesson from you on that. I mean, you mentioned your summarisers and co-commentators, however we want to call them, and obviously whether it's Ian Chappell and Jeff Boycott or whoever else on gymnastics and tennis. How do you find those relationships? Do you find them easy to come by? I'm not necessarily looking for a rap sheet, obviously, on all the people you've worked with, but it is about establishing a relationship, sometimes pretty quickly, perhaps if you're diving into something or it's quick, court-to-court stuff at Wimbledon and suddenly someone's rostered on differently because another game's overrun or those kind of things. So it is important for those relationships to come across well, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember meeting Jonty Rhodes, the great South African cricketer. I met him on the airwaves as he sat down next to me to commentate at a World T20 game. I was like, "Hi, Jonty, nice to meet you." And then you don't really have long to establish rapport. It's eye contact, it's a smile, it's a bit of body language, it's sort of opening up your shoulders to sort of just be a bit inclusive with them. There's lots of subtle, well, they're things which I don't even think you think about doing, but...
No, but that's good stuff. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, people who have observed others in the box have noted the way we kind of interact without even thinking about it. But yeah, certainly getting to know people away from the microphone absolutely helps when you're on the microphone. And that's where cricket in particular lends itself well, because we simply spend so much time with each other. And when you consider the first England trip I did, and generally the length of an England test at an ODI tour is 2 months. That's quite an inordinate an amount of time to go away on a work trip. And if you're doing that on a regular basis, you become a little family, a home from home, if you like. And my colleagues sort of became my brothers.
What's your role in most of the families that you're away with?
Well, thankfully, not a sort of mother figure, which would be what you might expect. No, we all muck in together. And happily now, and the environment has become, I always say, much more normal now because there are other women who are commentating. And, in particular... Yeah. Obviously, the numbers are greater if you cover a women's tournament. There tends to be more female commentators because you've got the ex-players who are summarising, etc., etc. But, I mean, that's one of the great things I'm grateful about in my career. I feel I've been able to make a difference. I would have felt as if all that, the effort and the pressure that I put myself under to do those first commentaries that I did, would have been somewhat of a waste if I had merrily, gone through a 20-year career and then afterwards... There was no other women, and the next person, whenever they did it, had to kind of put themselves under the whole same pressure that I went through. So I'm really pleased. There's a whole cohort of whether it's ex-players who now have an opportunity to step into the media, A, because women's sports got a greater profile, and B, because women's voices talking about sport in the commentary box has been normalised. And I would have felt that all that pressure would have been a waste if the next person had to sort of go through what I went through. That's not to say that those commentating in the box, women are still having, various sort of negative experiences, largely from social media and that sort of thing. But I think the actual environment, the industry, is fully embracing and accepting of it now. And that's a huge step.
Yeah, certainly. And I know, you know, when I spoke to Sarah and her talking about Pete Stevens at BBC London saying, I think you should commentate, and her response being, why? Because she just couldn't see that there was any point, because there was nowhere to go in her mind. There was no one had done it before. So therefore, why would there be a point to starting now when there isn't a future in it? Which obviously she has helped create, and others like Jackie and yourself do. I mean, you know, I do an awful lot of work in the women's rugby game, and it was one of my things, as I think I mentioned before, that, you know, my sister played, my cousin played, my dad had reffed women's rugby. I wanted to make sure I embraced any opportunity to cover women's sport as someone interested in it, rather than to be a career commentator that thought, okay, I probably have to do some of this women's stuff to get where I want to be. You know, absolutely relish and love covering it. And so I'm often in and around plenty of people that understand the challenges that women's sport has, and therefore to understand where women's commentators come from. And, you know, it's not something that I'm here with you to ring a massive bell on, because these conversations are happening more and more, which is great. But, you know, obviously someone like Sarah had a touch of the imposter syndrome. And when you mentioned earlier being 21 years of age and backing yourself and believing that you'll get there and you'll do it, I think that's a brilliant, that says a lot about you perhaps, but also you must feel pleased to see the landscape changing. And I guess the question is, do you feel less pressure now to be the person waving the flag that lets other people through the gate, or have you relaxed into it knowing that, okay, there are still challenges out there, probably as a woman compared to a man more so, but that things are moving more positively?
Yeah, I'm certainly much more able to be, well, I am able to be me in the commentary box and just in the work environment now. Mm. There was a sense, even when I started, that I wanted to blend in, I suppose. And I wouldn't wear, it sounds funny to say, I wouldn't wear particularly feminine clothes. I think it was a long time before I wore a skirt to work, for example. Right. I mean, I was a bit of a tomboy growing up anyway. So, I mean, I'm, you know, jeans, you know, I'm T-shirt and jeans now. I mean, that's kind of what I live in. But, you know, I love getting dressed up and all the rest of it. But I didn't overtly, go into a commentary box wearing high heels and a skirt, because it wasn't, I would have massively stood out, and I didn't want to have anybody regarding me in any other way other than a commentator. It was strange when I think back of it now. I relish and love the fact that, you know, I and hopefully all the other women I work with can be themselves. And it is, as I said, the environment is much more normal to spend your working life amongst men and women. You know, I think even now, though, if I went on an England tour, I would, in all likelihood, probably still be the only female in the press pack. If I'm thinking about the touring English media, for example, at the moment, and I think those who travel with England, of the written press, there wouldn't be a female that travels. The TMS team, you would have sort of myself, you'd have, Ebony. It'd be in the broadcast sense, you know, whether Isha would tour, you would, on the written front, though, there's still very few females that do the full touring thing, but those of us who are there, you can be yourself. You really can, and that's a huge part of the authenticity of commentating. And I wouldn't ever say that I wasn't myself when I was on air, but there were certain elements that I did rein back, such as I guess sort of, you know, not wanting to, you know, be overtly feminine at that time, because I didn't want to draw attention to that fact. Whereas, I think it's much more easily embraced now.
Yeah, I would agree. Very well put. You talk about the working life there. I mean, in terms of how the broadcast landscape looks I'm talking cricket here rather than the other bits and pieces you do. I mean, I know you worked on TV and you mentioned Channel 4 and Channel 5 and BBC Radio and all these sides of things. How do you see a future career? Does it worry you that there are less and less jobs for life in the way that there used to be in broadcasting, and that the landscape is 3 years of rights with this person or this broadcaster and then over to someone else? Are you calm about the future?
It does feel precarious, I think even more so with the situation we're in right now, with coronavirus for sure, and uncertainties over travel, let alone uncertainties over rights. But you can be highly successful in what you're doing And then through no fault of your own, a rights deal finishes and your job ends. And you don't necessarily automatically get picked up by the next person because they've got their cohort, you know, that broadcaster. And so it is quite a precarious industry. I think the portfolio career is the best way that you can manage it, is having different...
Do you mean by multi-sport?
Either multi-sport and just even multi-occupations in a sense. So I really enjoy the fact that I have a podcast that I do as well. So I've got the presenting side of it. I occasionally, less of late, but I'd present the Sport on the Today programme and I'd have the cricket. And then, yes, the tennis, Olympics, different elements. So that actually if any one falls down, you've got others to juggle. I think that is probably the best way of managing careers in our industry now. It's very unusual for, you know, somebody to be almost kind of full time with one broadcaster. It rarely happens these days. So yeah, as an industry, I think being agile is a really important aspect of it, and being able to accept change and roll with change and adapt. So multi-skilling, broadening your horizons, having an openness to change as well. Like, we can all get quite sort of fixed in our ways sometimes. So, you know, it's a great lesson right now with sport sort of halted due to COVID, is thinking, well, yeah, what will the future look like? And it's given everyone a chance to say, well, what else can I do? And again, it's that attitude and mindset, isn't it? Not about what can't I do at the moment. What I can't do is commentate on cricket right now. But it's having a can-do attitude and thinking, focusing on the opportunities rather than the things that potentially, certainly temporarily, have been taken away.
Yeah, and perhaps people like yourself who have just done it from the beginning are going to be going to continue to be the sort of people that can do the opportunities that come up. Just before I get to the sort of last question, there was something actually that I made a note on, and I didn't ask at the time, so this will sort of drop into an earlier chat really. But you mentioned when we first talked about you're playing sport at school and at university, the sort of, you know, living through the pain of the penalties, all this kind of thing. I just wanted to ask, how much do you find, or do you think it's valid, perhaps, to be able to draw on amateur sporting experience, amateur moments of sporting psychology that you might have had, not to a high level necessarily, or, you know, not as a paid professional, but that give you insight as someone who's now got a broadcaster's microphone, to be able to, I don't know, take that to the listener with a little bit of you going with it?
I suppose it goes into the mix, doesn't it? Because everything that you are watching, you're viewing through the lens of your past experiences. And so I suppose you can have a certain empathy. I mean, not to the extent as obviously of knowing what it's like to be a professional out there in that instant with, you know, 50,000 people or more watching you and crowds and so on. But I suppose being, whether you've been a sports fan or you've played it, I think the fact that you have the ability and that empathy or just the sensibilities to ride the highs and lows of the moment is probably what goes into the mix of commentating. Because, you know, there's absolutely sports that I've commentated on that I have never played that particular sport in my life. You know, I've certainly never swung myself around asymmetric bars or, you know, done a backflip on a balance beam or a round off double twisting Yurchenko.
I look forward to you ordering those from Amazon while we're in lockdown and catching up on your progress.
Yeah, it's my next order of Uber.
And I guess part of it, where you have had experience, or at least if you've had the experience of finding the mental challenge of being in a high stakes final, whether it's at school or university or whatever, you've got some empathy. It might not be to the scale of the person out there in the middle in front of a 50,000 crowd, but actually some empathy perhaps to bring your co-commentator in or have the insight to ask the right question of the person who has the proper experience, because maybe it occurs to you this is probably where they're at. And I think that would be my opinion maybe on where it's got a bit more relevance.
Yeah, bringing your summariser in and teasing out what they felt at the time, I mean, that is what they're there for. I suppose being first and foremost, if you're a sports fan, your greatest empathy is kind of with your listener, with your audience and with the crowd. Yeah. And actually as a commentator, maybe that's what makes it the the important thing to ride with, because you're projecting to them. They're the people who you're talking to, and you want to draw out an ability to sort of translate the tension that they are experiencing and to transmit that to those who aren't at the spectacle themselves, to bring that drama in so that those people who aren't in the stadium, they can feel that very same tension as well. So I think the fact that if you're a sports lover, even if you haven't actually played that sport, you identify and therefore can communicate the tension and the drama of the moment. Maybe that's where it comes.
Who out there do you think is doing good work at the moment with the commentary mic in hand?
Oof. There's no one who's not, really. It's a massively sort of competitive field in a way. If you look at, you know, the number of commentators actually is what has ballooned. Opportunity now has never been so great because of, speaking from a cricketing sense, the myriad of T20 tournaments that have sprung up, domestic leagues, and the proliferation of those means there's now more opportunity than ever, which is only a good thing because, again, when I think of when I started, I looked around the local radio scene, which is where you wanted to cut your teeth, and every local radio station had one person who was their cricket reporter who had been doing that job for the last 20 years and was probably going to be doing it for the next 20 years. And you think, well, where do you even get your chance? Whereas BBC Radio Now doing commentary on every...
Run them over in the car park is how you get your chance. No, sorry. I don't
know. Are you speaking from experience, Nick? Yeah, you now look at the number of commentaries that the BBC puts out every summer and the number of commentators who are able to be involved is amazing. And then you step up to that international level and the leagues going around the world and people who are kind of living life out of suitcases and travelling around doing cricket. There is so much opportunity. So I think that keeps everyone on their toes of making sure that, you're still the best that you can be, which is probably only a good thing for the listener, I suppose, that we're all trying to strive to carry on doing a good job all the time. You can't get complacent, that's for sure.
Yeah, looking over our shoulders the whole time. Looking at the moment in the future that you decide that it's all been enough. You've been given your opportunity to have your last dream gig. It can be a one-off one-day international. It could be over a weekend. Could be over a week. What would be your dream last gig?
Ooh, dream final gig. Well, if we could just replay the 2019 World Cup final, I wouldn't mind having a crack at that. I mean, what an amazing, unbelievable roller coaster of a day, and the way that it finished. But what's coming up? We've got other World Cups. We've got T20 World Cups, Ashes. I've been fortunate to be able to say the words "England have won the Ashes" in a women's sense. So it'd be pretty cool to call a men's Ashes home, and indeed to. Call a winning moment on a men's World Cup because I've called the winning moment on a women's. So perhaps there'd be sort of bucket list ones always. You want a winning moment, don't you?
You probably do.
I'm gonna be greedy.
Yeah, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. So men's Ashes final, calling that home and a couple more World Cups. That sounds good to me. Ali, thank you so much for your time. You're clearly someone that is dedicated to their prep and therefore their craft. That comes through in all the work that you do, and you are managing what comes across as a great and very nicely balanced career. All power to you for that continuing, and we look forward to hearing you when you're next on the airwaves, and for those listening during lockdown for when we've got some support for you as well. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Nick. You keep up your good work as well. Great fun.
Thank you. Well, my thanks to Ali Mitchell, who I think you'll agree was another superb guest. I particularly enjoyed hearing about how the sport occasionally gets in the way of having a chat with your summarisers on TMS. If that doesn't tell you about the style of TMS, I don't know what does. I also loved hearing how Alison got into commentating on the pommel horse. Wasn't that great? It has to be said, and will be said no doubt another 100 times, I'm sure. But those opportunities when working for a national broadcaster to turn your your hand to other sports. Just incredible. I also really like what Alison said about feeling that early pressure, but now hoping that the work she's done has made it easier for other women to follow suit. So quite right too. I hope you've enjoyed it. iTunes to leave me a review. Please do. It's at Q Commentator on Twitter. I'm on at Nick Heath Sport. Series 3 starts next week. Hooray! You take care, keep well, and bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.